of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North. Today, our Project Milwaukee series is focusing on making changes within the classroom to address a worrisome achievement gap between ethnic groups in MPS. More than half of MPS students are African American, about 23% Hispanic. Only about 12% are white. But on average, white MPS students consistently outperform students of color on the standardized WKCE tests. Last school year, there was a 24 percentage point gap between African-American and white eighth graders in reading proficiency, and the difference widens as the students enter higher grades. This gap is particularly large in math proficiency. In eighth grade, there was a 29 percentage point difference between black and white students. By 10th grade, it was 37 points, and Hispanic eighth grade students scored an average 14 percentage points below their white peers in both reading and math. UWM professors Festus Obiakor and Renee Antrop-Gonzalez both study minority learners and urban school districts and question what's allowing for this achievement gap for MPS students of color. They spoke with Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce, and Antrop-Gonzalez says the gap is a product of what he calls institutional racism.
I think that many of the things that are tolerated in MPS as a system would never be tolerated in an all-white district, and especially a district that is conceived as being as middle class. So I think that a lot of things are tolerated and accepted precisely because most students in MPS are children of color who live in poverty and poor whites. And so I think basically to build off the concept that other educational scholars have talked about, I think that we really are living a system of apartheid education or apartheid through schooling vis-a-vis a large urban school district that is not meeting the needs of most of its students.
Is this purposeful on the part of the leadership, or is it perhaps more subconscious that perhaps these children are just slipping through the cracks, basically?
Yeah, Dr. Edgar Epps, a colleague of mine, said this is purposeful from his sociological perspective because a system that is designed to really keep the less fortunate is systemic. You know, it's like we want to keep the caste the way it is. We want people to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. But ladies and gentlemen, some people have boots, but they don't have straps. And some have straps, they don't have boots. If we come to the realization that this phenomenon exists, then we know what to do to solve the problem.
Most of the work that we do is informed by the voices of youth, the youth themselves, who were enrolled in middle schools and high schools in this city. And in fact, I just had a conversation with a young African-American man. He's in sixth grade and middle school. I asked him what school he went to, and he did state the school that he went to. And he rightfully said, but it's a really racist place. I go, well, say more about that. Remember, this is a sixth grade young man who's talking about racism and how he sees it in schools and how it affects him personally. He said, well, I always get the impression that the kids who look like me are the ones getting picked on and the ones getting suspended and expelled. And the folks who don't look like me can do the same kinds of things, and they're excused. And so he felt that from his experiences as a sixth grader in this city, that he was a recipient of everyday what we call microaggressions, acts of racism that he feels on an everyday basis. We could go back to also talk about macroaggressions. To what extent then do systems really perpetuate and carry out acts of racism? So I think that in many cases, this is done very purposefully to lessen the life chances and structures of opportunity of youth, especially poor whites and youth of color.
Where do teachers fall into this? Are they just perhaps unwitting pawns in kind of a broader racist scheme? You tell me.
There are great teachers out there, and those teachers work very hard to save those kids, to help those kids to maximize their fullest potential. But there are also some teachers who do not really care about those kids. Are they there to make some money? Some are willing participants, some are unwilling participants. So you can even get it to those who prepared those teachers. Some of the teachers tell me, you know, they wish they took some multicultural education class. And even when they were taking these classes, sometimes they didn't go deeper in addressing the issues that they'll be confronting when they graduate from these programs. The wrong patterns have been practiced consistently that they've become tradition.
All teachers have the potential to be excellent teachers and really become allies with their students and their and the communities in which the students reside and their families. What we often find out, however, is that many seem to have what's called a blame the victim kind of deficit way of looking at children. So an example of this, well, if their parents would only care more about their education, and my counterargument has always been, so do we really believe that parents or caregivers wake up in the morning and say to themselves, I want my child to fail today. I do not want my child to succeed. That is not the case whatsoever. In fact, what our work shows is that on the contrary, parents, caregivers care very much about their children's education. So I think that we have to do a lot more work in terms of raising consciousness around the blaming the victim paradigm, because it lets institutions off the hook. Exclusive blame is placed on students rather than seeing students as they're all capable of learning. We have to hold them to high expectations. And so I think that as a result of our thinking about students in these kinds of deficit racist kinds of ways, our teaching practices end up manifesting our ideologies.
How so?
Low expectations, as an example. The whole notion of a dumbed-down pedagogy. Are we looking at critical dialogue around social justice issues? Are we looking at making sense to the extent to which our curriculum is relevant to our students' lives versus rote memorization and worksheets? Are we engaging in acts of producing students who are mere robots and parrot things? The notion that students have nothing to bring to the table. All of our students already have a knowledge base that they bring to the table. How do we build on that knowledge base and make the curriculum more relevant to their needs, interests, and desires?
I'm going to talk about two critical issues here that actually affect the whole educational programming. The first one is the myth of socioeconomic dissonance. That is that poverty leads to poor intelligence, poor zest for knowledge, poor parenting. That's why you have the poor neighborhood, poor schools, poor this, poor that. As if when one grows poor, they cannot be rich intellectually. Also the myth of biological determinism, where you think that, you know, one is genetically born not to succeed. These are the kind of beliefs that are totally dangerous to the education of children. If I believe that you're not intellectually capable in the first place anyway,
exactly,
how can I educate you? You're beyond redemption. Then if I believe that you're poor, you don't have money anyway, so, you know, you don't have zest for success, you want to be poor. The reality is that all individuals have some form of mental capacity. No brain is a tabula rasa. No brain is a blank slate. We need to find what interests individuals, the unique abilities that individuals bring to the table, and take advantage of those unique abilities.
One of the things we have heard from teachers who we've talked to for this series is that they feel that often their ability to teach students is hindered by the fact that students come in having seen violence in their neighborhoods or not having a healthy lunch or something like that, where the teacher has so many students bringing in these kinds of issues, they may make gains, but they may not make the kinds of gains that perhaps administration wants them to make.
Well, I understand that argument, but I do not believe that poverty alone is responsible for children not performing. There are myriad problems that confront children and teachers. Those teachers believe that all teachers are truly good. You see, I would like teachers to say some of us are really not good, just like we're saying here. You know, some of us are self-destructive to those kids. You know, then if you look at the other premise with regard to intelligence, violent neighborhoods, well, why is it that kids who are actually growing up in war zones in Africa and many parts of the world do excel in education? I think we need to get out of all these kinds of assumptions that are deficit-oriented and understand that, yes, a child might come from maybe a poor background, but that child might not have poor intelligence.
And again, not to dismiss poverty at all, because I think poverty is a very real force that does impact the educational achievement of students. Nonetheless, we have to be very careful about falling into the trap of saying, well, because students come from backgrounds of poverty, they can't learn. Why do this? Why take the time and energy, really, to engage in a meaningful, culture-relevant curriculum around high expectations?
You know, we need to get out of the faculty lounge mentality of talking about parents, how bad they are. They already disenfranchised, we know that. But we can bring them into the system. Then we also need to reward teachers who are doing good, because so many teachers are doing good. I believe in merit pay. Let's pay good teachers. Let's reward good teachers. Let's honor good teachers. You know, I just don't believe that every teacher is good, and I don't believe that every teacher is bad. That's where the teachers' union has to really work on recognizing its best of the best and reward its best of the best. Then for leadership, school leaders need to know that they're part of the equation. We've seen cases of school leaders coming and saying, I just learned this, heard about this yesterday. Teachers, you do this. We need to involve school leaders who are totally involved. I've gone to schools where the school leader doesn't even know what's going on in the school. We need school leaders who care.
I also think it's important to talk about the extent, going back to how students define good teachers. Because, again, I think that student voices are very powerful. I'd like to, if I could, mention Erika, who was a student who we spoke with in one of our projects, a Puerto Rican high achiever. And her definition, I thought, was very powerful. And she said the following. A good teacher is one who knows you, cares about what you do, pushes students, and cares about the stuff going on in your life. A good teacher also wants you to absorb information and understand it. One other student, Cecilia, also mentioned the following. A good teacher is someone who cares enough not to accept low-quality work. I like being pushed and told that I can do better. Mm-hmm. Some of my better teachers are like this. So while the students that we speak with are able to very eloquently provide definitions in terms of what a good teacher does or looks like, they'll often remark, while we have a definition, many of our teachers don't fit the definition. They may be able to think of a couple of teachers over their 12 years of schooling that have indeed done these kinds of things. So first and foremost, I think it's very important that teachers and other school agents, such as administrators and others, are very willing to engage in highly personal, meaningful relationships with their students and vice versa to get to know their students. Then again, in most of our work is done at the high school level. When you're in a high school, in large comprehensive high schools with over 1,000 students, and you have class sizes at 40 and 45, for instance, it becomes much more of a challenge to build those kinds of relationships with your students. That's why I've always been a proponent for smaller class sizes, which in many schools you're not seeing. Things, again, that would not be tolerated in suburban schools. And not to idealize suburban schools, but nonetheless, I think things would be very different. If you had class sizes of 40 and 45, that would not be tolerated for very long.
Festus, you study at-risk learners, and Renee, sure. You study high achievers, minority high achievers specifically. In both cases, is the attention just not being paid to minority students who are either at risk or minority students who are high achievers? What can be done to better recognize these students and better reach them, better assist them to reach those goals?
Something should be bothering people when they look at all programs for students with behavior disorders. They see many, many culturally and linguistically diverse students in there. Then when you go to gifted programs, you see mostly white students or students who come from well-to-do homes. Something is wrong with that picture. But when a school like Mesmer takes hold of those children, these kids are going to wonderful colleges. What happened? Did their brains just grow just in one day? I think we really need to understand that in some of these programs, they spend 99% of the time trying to flog the devil out of the children and 1% of the time trying to impart knowledge into the children. I think we need to change that and do what is done in many suburban schools where they spend 99% of the time trying to educate these kids and 1% of the time trying to discipline these kids.
As an educational scholar, I had always been interested in learning more about the schooling experiences of urban youth of color. And what's interesting is that over the last about 40 to 50 years, a lot of the scholarship ends up talking about causes for failure, causes for students being pushed out. So not to dismiss the scholarship, this is very important scholarship. nonetheless, I was seeing a gap in the literature. And the gap that I was noting was there really is very little mention about high-achieving youth of color in urban public schools. So I was very interested then in talking with high-achieving Latina and Latino students about their schooling experiences. And it's like, so what factors have contributed to your success? What's interesting about all this is that these student voices provide what we call a counter-narrative, the master narrative being these kids don't care about their education, their parents don't care. What do you expect from kids who live in poverty, right? This is a counter-narrative saying it's precisely our neighborhoods and families that have supported us and have helped us become successful academically. So they rarely credited school agents with their success, which I think is a very strong statement about the way that schools are set up to fail students. With that said, too, I think we also have to acknowledge the fact that there's a huge racial and ethnic and linguistic disjuncture between teachers and students in our schools. So I think it is problematic when 85 to 90% of urban teachers nationally, and it happens here in Milwaukee as well, are white women. Not to say that white women cannot be allies and work well with students of color. Our students are seeing teachers who don't look like them, who don't come from their neighborhoods. And so to what extent are we also recruiting and retaining teachers of color who come from the neighborhoods in which our students reside? So again, not to dismiss the important role that some white teachers can play in terms of their work and the potential for them to be allies. Nonetheless, we have to ask ourselves, why is there such a large racial ethnic disjuncture in our urban schools? This is highly problematic.
Well, let me say, Festus, Renee, thank you both so much for coming in and talking to us about these issues.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Festus Obiakor is a professor in the Department of Exceptional Education at UWM. He's a nationally and internationally known scholar and consultant. His research interests include at-risk learners, African-American and urban learners, and behavior management. Renee Antrop Gonzalez is an associate professor in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. He teaches bilingual education courses, and his research interests include studying minority high achievers and urban school reform. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Coming up next on the show, can technology be the answer to achievement? We'll find out. More of Lake Effect right after this short break. This is WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.